This is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, we'll take a look at the use of torture as a tool in the war against terror. Also, we'll look at a British opera that says that its performers should no longer perform in blackface. Joining us at our New York Bureau, Bob Meadows, writer for People magazine. Also in the Bureau there in New York, Marcelo Suarez Orozco. He's a professor and co-director of immigration studies at New York University. And from our headquarters in Washington, D.C., Dr. Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. I thank you all. Let's get right into what is being seen as a closer look at the idea of whether the United States has in fact engaged in torture in relation to its, quote, fight against terror. Mary Frances Berry, we are starting to see hairs being split, if you will, particularly by the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. I think without saying to a great degree, the Bush administration outside of Abu Ghraib has admitted almost to engaging in some forms and acts of terror in the need or in the word, I should say, of saving us against the terrorist. How much do you buy that this is going to explode in the face of the Bush administration?
I'm not sure, because the House has not passed any legislation or even considered any, while all the debate that the public has been transfixed with is going on in the Senate with McCain and others, with the bills that have been passed there. But everyone in the country should know by now, given what's been publicly disclosed, that the United States has used torture. I mean, that shouldn't even be up for a debate. And also, one can tell from the comments of Rumsfeld and Cheney and others that the administration intends to use torture again if they feel that they believe that they should. I myself am so cynical about this that I think that even if a bill were passed, and remember, there's nothing up for passage in the House, that if they felt they needed to engage in torture, they would probably do it. They have said that they want the CIA to be able to do it. Everyone who knows the history of torture knows that people lie when they're being tortured. They give false information. It doesn't really help. It's not that it's going to make things any better or that you're going to get a better information, but I think that they are bound and determined. Most of the public now doesn't even talk about Abu Ghraib. You don't see anything about it in the news or anywhere else. They think that people will forget this debate too, and that they will use it if they believe they need to use it.
Mm-hmm. Marcelo, we heard from President Carter just a few moments ago in talking about the idea that in his mind it's almost unbelievable to suggest that we are actually publicly talking about torture as a tool. Yet one would say historically, behind the curtain in Oz, we know that it has gone on. Are you surprised that it has become so public?
Torture has been used in various contexts. We have the French experience in Algeria. We have the experience in Indochina, Vietnam. We have, of course, the widespread use of torture in Latin America. And what the historical record, what the comparative record suggests, is that torture really doesn't work. Torture only works in terms of spreading terror in a population, which is, in the current context, not the best way to proceed as we ease out of Iraq and as we try to, let's say, win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi population. The fact that this is being discussed now is in a way a symptom of a policy that is out of control, where there are contradictions, where there are ambiguities, where really there is a lack of clarity moving forward as to how we're dealing with a mess in Iraq.
Bob, what of the idea that there is no real benevolence in war, some would say, and the thought that this is all just part and parcel of what goes on, and doggone it, get a grown-up view of what's happening?
You know, it's really that's really a definitely strong issue, because certainly the idea of torture is reprehensible to most people, but it is and the United States has had policies against it. But when you're out in the field, I imagine, and you're in the war and you're seeing your buddies being blown up and you're seeing them being tortured, it seems like that's really what we're trying to protect against, and it's really not being done. That type of thing is perhaps a bit more understandable, but it seems like what the White House is discussing and his plans to veto is calculated torture, where you're actually planning to torture people, and that's what I think is something, yeah, in the heat of war, it's one thing. But, boy, when you're out there and planning to torture people that you're going to try and interrogate, that's a whole different level and I think really needs to be looked at.
One of the things that amazes me about this discussion all the time is how policymakers, we're not talking about people on the battlefield somewhere who may in a moment of hot anger do something,
exactly.
But how policymakers who have available to them information about the history of torture and what it does and how ineffective it is and all the rest of it would make policies, as Bob said, to calculate, to engage in it and seriously think that this is a great idea when they should be leading the way and not understanding that if you perpetuate torture, then that means that your own forces are at greater risk of being tortured. I just don't, you know, it just amazes me that this illogicality proceeds with this discussion all the time.
Yeah. All right, we'll move to a list that has been making headlines over the course of the last couple of days. This is a list that is produced by Morgan Quitno Press, a publishing company that over the years has looked at the 10 safest and 10 most dangerous, or I should say 20 safest and 20 most dangerous cities in the country. The list is controversial by virtue of, and we'll get into that in a moment, how the basic categories of crime are put together, and then, of course, the list derived from that. But of the top 10 cities, number one, Camden, New Jersey, then Detroit, St. Louis, Flint, Michigan, Richmond, Virginia, Baltimore, Atlanta, New Orleans, Gary, Indiana, and Birmingham rounds out the top 10. One of the interesting notes there, Mary Frances Berry, as we take a look at that, these are majority-minority cities, and many of them, the majority of them, are very poor cities. Does this speak to the idea that obviously violence and poverty often go hand in hand in this country, but it also speaks, when you look at that list, to a group of cities that have fallen on hard times and have been there for decades. Any hope of these cities climbing off of this list and out of this kind of despair?
Every single one of these cities, as you said, and even going down to the whole 20 of the cities, they are places where unemployment, devastation, some were old manufacturing cities and now there are no jobs and no one has done anything. Others are places where there have been pockets of poverty, poor people with no development forever, as long as anyone can remember. And any plans that local people make or governors about what to do in the state always passes them by. So you would expect robbery and all the violent crimes, and of course those crimes should be punished, but that's not really the issue. The issue is there any way to make it better? And if you contrasted those with the safest cities, every single one of those is a bedroom city or an exurb or someplace where the people have money, where you don't have to worry about it. And if you were to look there to see what kind of crimes were committed, you'd find embezzlement, white-collar crime, domestic violence, and other kinds of things. So obviously there's a connection between the situation of these cities that they found themselves in, drugs, other things, places where the people from the exurbs buy drugs, that makes them on this list. So rather than just lamenting and saying, oh my gosh, they're still on the list, if anyone really wanted to do something about it, sure, they'd punish the crime and accelerate that, but they would do something so that these places would not continue to be bypassed, so that every single time you do this survey, you come up with the answer that you already know you'll get when you do the survey.
We should note, though, that the methodology used by the publishing company has come under attack regularly by criminologists and sociologists who criticize the company for not placing the data in context. It gives equal weight to six basic crime categories. That's homicide, rape, robbery, aggravated assault, burglary, and motor vehicle theft. That being said, Bob Meadows, these are violent and dangerous cities, often, as Mary suggested, left in despair for years. When you look at the idea that so many people said that Katrina, quote, uncovered poverty, which we have found laughable often on this program, the idea that this list does not uncover the violence that many of these folks live in, for those of us who look at this, isn't it time for America to take a deep, hard look in the mirror and really, as Mary suggests, correct some of these problems, because it cannot be done solely locally?
Yeah, and the cities have tried Camden, I read, has the redevelopment program in the works. You know, of course, you know, you're not being from Detroit. You know, we know all that the cities have done there. These, as Dr. Berry said, these are cities that have had long legacies of this. Detroit has always been a very hardscrabble city, even back when it was predominantly white. Boy, you know, it was Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty, Martin Luther King, that became his big issue. These have been ideas that have been tossed around, but what it seems like is every time that the country gets going pretty well economically, the Republican administrations always come in and start cutting taxes and cutting programs, and so anything that poor people even had to hold on to is taken away from them. I'm just,
Marcelo, you know, I said in Detroit this week, when you hear the announcement from GM, 30,000 jobs lost, many of them are going to affect, particularly the ripple effect in the belt here, the Midwest belt here, where a lot of auto industries have had their plants and the like. One cannot assume that any of this bodes well for these cities. What do you believe can be done to help spark a resurrection, if you will, of these cities?
Well, again, it goes back to the issue of work and of meaningful opportunities. The work of Bill Wilson at Harvard on the disappearance of work very, very powerfully suggests that when work disappears, when there are lack of meaningful job opportunities, when you confound that with anomie, with a lack of the patterns of social cohesion and the social strictures that that can prevent the kind of data that we're looking at, we really need to be thinking in terms of a massive reinvestment in meaningful job opportunities at a time when the global economy sees a growth in the outsourcing of our jobs, good jobs are disappearing, and this moving forward suggests a lot of serious problems in these large metropolitan core centers, where our African-American, our Latino, our minority populations are really resegregating and hyper-concentrating and confounding deep poverty with deep segregation.
And it may happen, too, that if something isn't done, that the next time they do this survey, some of these other places in the country where these plants are closing down and things are being outsourced. I noticed Oklahoma City was big in the news last night as a place where GM is closing down plants, that if we don't do something about making work for people, meaningful work for people everywhere, we may see some additions to this list the next time it comes out.
Mary, yes, how realistic is it to believe that something along the lines of a Marshall Plan, if you will, might be really broached by politicians?
It's not going to happen in Washington. Governors, it seems to me that governors of these states need to take the lead and legislatures in the states on trying to come up with something. In some states, they have tried, and they've lacked resources generally throughout the state. In others, there hasn't been really any focus. And people have tried. If you look at this list, Cleveland, they tried building a stadium. A lot of places in Baltimore built a stadium. People build stadiums and hope that that brings some jobs. But given the massive problems in these areas and how long they've been going on, it's difficult. But I point out something else. Not all places in all of these cities are dangerous. If you look at the list, Washington's on the list, like at 13. Not all of Washington, D.C. is dangerous. It's the places where the poor people live and have no work. Not all of New Orleans, even now, after Katrina, the French Quarter isn't dangerous. The Garden District is not. Atlanta is not dangerous everywhere. What we're talking about is places where, and the more concentrated the poverty is, and the more poor people and unemployed people are there in the cities on this list, and the longer it's been going on without anybody doing anything about it, then except lamentations, then you see that the problem is more concentrated and more difficult to deal with. It's very interesting, but it's a challenge for policymakers to say deal with it.
Yet, Bob Meadows, what's interesting here is the browning of these cities that we've been seeing, or in cases like Washington or Detroit, the flat-out blacking of these cities, if you will. Perception is everything, and there are going to be those who will not associate the idea that the overwhelming string here that runs through all of these cities is poverty. People are going to equate that also with the idea of black and brown folks just can't control themselves.
Even though Flint is 40% white and St. Louis is 43% white, you're absolutely right. That is what it's going to be associated with. That is what it is associated with. Blacks, the median household income for blacks in this country is $30,000. That is, it's not officially poor, but you know if your household is earning $30,000 a year, you are pretty much struggling. These are issues that they don't have a color, but color is assigned to them. And so, yeah, people are definitely going to look at this as a black and brown issue.
And Marcelo, the catch-22 here is what Bob spoke to with the idea of this kind of list coming out. It makes prospective investors and others leery about going into these cities and infusing money.
Sure. And the other thing we didn't talk about is the issue of education. Again, in the context of developing meaningful work that will not be outsourced to China, to India, to other parts of the world, we really need to rethink the role of education in the generation of meaningful work opportunities for our minority populations moving forward.
I need to make just one other point, Ed, and that is that the answer to this problem, according to some urban experts, is gentrification. And in the cities on this list where some gentrification is ongoing and is taking place, the idea is that they'll move off the list that way. Of course, that doesn't answer the issue of what happens to the poor people, because in gentrification, they lose. But the city can get taken off the list by gentrified. It's a very interesting conundrum.
And is not always an easy equation, as we saw with Detroit in particular, that gentrification about 15, 20 years ago looked as though it was turning the corner and whites were coming back and then that stumbled and certainly has to a great degree hurt the city by virtue of tax base and all. All right, folks, thanks so much. We were going to talk about blackface being banned in the opera overseas, but we'll get to that maybe tomorrow. Thank you, folks. Mary, Bob, Marcelo, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.